coming to this lecture on the art of love with Ovid as your don.
This is the course our chariot will cover, the ground that we're commissioned to go over.
One, work to find somebody to enamour. Come at it like a soldier, new to armour.
Two, win over the person you've impressed.
Three, make sure it's a love time can test.
So, are you looking out for an affair? There's someone out there for you, just find out where. While you can go wherever the lead is off, pick someone you can tell just you I love.
Love won't come falling through the gentle skies. The right one should be looked for with your eyes. Bird catchers know the shrubs, hooked anglers know the waters where the biggest fish schools flow.
You could try theatres. Yes, look around. You pray for love? Then this is fertile ground. Whether you want to love or just to play, you'll find a one-night stand or one who'll stay.
In long queues... In long queues, ants come and go back again, conveying their provisions grain by grain, and fragrances of thyme and nectar lead bees buzzing flower by flower through the mead.
We women go to plays, and so you go, and from our shoulders upwards is your show. Go on, look, there's no law to stop you gawking. Shh. Here, eyebrows and gestures do the talking. Boys, rise when we rise, when we sit, sit still.
A waste of time? No, do your girlfriend's will. Who would have thought law courts were good for love? The spark's there, even in a lawyer's proof. Yes, hard by Venus's temple, Apaeus wets the air by pulsing jets out of water.
Your barrister can take his brief from Cupid. So smart with others' pleas, for his he's stupid. He who has left his statutes on the shelf in this deserted spot pleads for himself. The suitor is no longer pressing suits, and stuck inside her temple, Venus hoots.
And don't rule out a chariot race. The circus offers everyone a space. Oh, look, an empty seat. Sit by her side, then put your side beside her side and slide.
Here, rows create a squash. As a result, I can't avoid your touch. Your job is to strike up a friendly chat, and platitudes can move from this to that. Eagerly ask about whose horse is whose. Make sure my favourite is the one you choose.
Oh, they're off. Oh, your lap got dusty.
You don't say. He really wants to finger dust away.
You should have. You should exploit these small emergencies. And if there's no dust, just pretend there is. Or if her clothes have lost too much, be diligent. Scoop up and spill some grit.
So gentlemanly. And he claims his prize. He keeps his peepers fixed upon my thighs.
The circus has potential for a fling, as does the sorry gladiator's ring.
Cupid has often wrestled in that dirt. Those watching battles can themselves be hurt. They've sensed the tender dart, groaned at the blow, and have themselves become part of the show.
Dinners are circumstances that combine a couch, a girl, you, and the god of wine. So pray to him, the creature of the night, in case the drinking puts your brain to flight. Don't drink more units than the accepted norm. Your brain and feet have duties to perform. Real drunks offend, so just pretend you're tight. Slip sometimes, seldom say your F is right.
Women should come late. By the candlelight. Delay is good. Delay leads to delight. Whatever you look like, drunk men think you're hot. And nightshades any weaknesses you've got.
Night pardons blemishes. It can conceal all flaws, and everyone has sex appeal. Examine precious jewels, purple dyes, face and bodies under daylit skies.
Thanks for that. So, now we've told you where to lay traps, where to look for an affair. Later, we'll share skills you'll need to impress, with tips on how women and men should dress. That lecture ought to give you all assurance, so concentrate, boys, even if you're morons.
Get down, little Henry Lee, and stay all night with me. You won't find a girl in this damn world that will compare with me.
Outside her kitchen window, the hedgerow glistened as if the snow possessed a light of its own. When the sky darkened towards evening, an unearthly reflected pallor remained behind upon the winter's landscape, while still the soft flakes floated down. This lovely girl, whose skin possesses that same inner light, so you would have thought she too was made all of snow, pauses in her chores in the mean kitchen to look out at the country road. Father said he would be home before nightfall. But the old car, stuck fast in a rut, wouldn't budge an inch. The engine whirred, coughed, and died, and he was far from home. Ruined once, then ruined again, as he had learnt from his lawyers that very morning. And not even enough money left over to buy his beauty, his girl child, his pet, the one white rose she said she wanted. The only gift she wanted. He cursed the useless car, the last straw that broke his spirit. Then, nothing for it but to fasten his old sheepskin coat around him, abandon the heap of metal, and set down off the snow-filled lane to look for help. Behind wrought iron gates, a short snowy drive performed a reticent flourish before a miniature, perfect Palladian house that seemed to hide itself shyly behind snow-laden skirts of an antique cypress. It was almost night. That house, with its sweet, retiring, melancholy grace, would have seemed deserted but for a light that flickered in an upstairs window, so vague it might have been the reflection of a star, if any stars could have penetrated the snow that whirled yet more thickly. Chilled through, he pressed the latch of the gate and saw, with a pang, how, on the withered ghost of a tangle of thorns, there clung still the faded rag of a white rose. The gate clanged loudly shut behind him, too loudly. And, from a distance, though from what distance he could not tell, he heard the most singular sound in the world. A great roaring, as of a beast of prey. In too much need to allow himself to be intimidated, he squared up to the mahogany door. Before, however, he could announce his presence, the door swung silently inward on well-oiled hinges, and he saw a white hall where the candles of a great chandelier cast their benign light upon so many, many flowers in great freestanding jars of crystal, that it seemed the whole of spring drew him into its warmth with a profound intake of perfumed breath. Yet there was no living person in the hall. The door behind him closed as silently as it had opened. Yet, this time, he felt no fear, although he knew by the pervasive atmosphere of a suspension of reality that he had entered a place of privilege, where all the laws of the world he knew need not necessarily apply. For the very rich are often very eccentric, and the house was plainly that of an exceedingly wealthy man. as it was, when nobody came to help him with his coat, he took it off himself. At that, the crystals of the chandelier tinkled a little, as if emitting a pleased chuckle, and the door of a cloakroom opened of its own accord. When he emerged again into the hall, he found a greeting waiting for him at last. There was, of all things, a liver and white King Charles Spaniel crouched with head intelligently cocked on the kiln runner. It gave him further comforting proof of his unseen host's wealth and eccentricity to see the dog wore, in place of a collar, a diamond necklace. The dog sprang to its feet in welcome and busily shepherded him, how amusing, to a snug little leather panel study on the first floor, where a low table was drawn up to a roaring log fire. On the table, a silver tray. Round the neck of the whiskey decanter, a silver tag with the legend, "Drink me," while the cover of the silver dish was engraved with the exhortation, "Eat me," in a flowing hand. This dish contained sandwiches of thick-cut roast beef, still bloody. He drank the one with soda and ate the other with some excellent mustard thoughtfully provided in a stoneware pot. And when the spaniel saw to it he had served himself, she trotted off about her own business. All that remained to make Beauty's father entirely comfortable was to find, in a curtained recess, not only a telephone, but the card of a garage that advertised a 24-hour rescue service. A couple of calls later, and he had confirmed, thank God, there was no serious trouble, only the car's age and the cold weather. Could he pick it up from the village in an hour? Miraculously, the storm had cleared as the moon rose, and now a glance between the velvet curtains revealed a landscape as of ivory with an inlay of silver. Then the spaniel appeared again, with his hat in her careful mouth, prettily wagging her tail, as if to tell him it was time to be gone, that this magical hospitality was over. Great wreaths of snow now precariously curded the rose trees, and when he brushed against a stem on his way to the gate, a chill armful softly thudded to the ground to reveal, as if miraculously preserved beneath it, one last single perfect rose that might have been the last rose left living in all the white winter, and of so intense and yet delicate a fragrance, it seemed to ring like a dulcimer on the frozen air. How could his host, so mysterious, so kind, deny Beauty her present? Not now distant, but close at hand, close as that mahogany front door, rose a mighty, furious roaring. The garden seemed to hold its breath in apprehension. But still, because he loved his daughter, Beauty's father stole the rose. At that, every window of the house blazed with furious light and a fugal baying, as of a pride of lions, introduced his host. There is always a dignity about great bulk, an assertiveness, a quality of being more there than most of us are. The being who now confronted Beauty's father seemed to him, in his confusion, vaster than the house he owned, ponderous yet swift. And the moonlight glittered on his great mazy head of hair, on the eyes green as agate, on the golden hairs of the great paws that grasped his shoulders, so that their claws pierced the sheepskin as he shook him like an angry child shakes a doll. This leonine apparition shook Beauty's father until his teeth rattled and then dropped him sprawling on his knees, while the spaniel, darting from the open door, danced round them, yapping distractedly, like a lady at whose dinner party blows have been exchanged. My good fellow, stammered Beauty's father, but the only response was a renewed roar. Good fellow! I am no good fellow. I am the beast, and you must call me beast, while I call you thief. Forgive me for robbing your garden, beast. Head of a lion, mane and mighty paws of a lion. He reared on his hind legs like an angry lion, yet wore a smoking jacket of dull red brocade, and was the owner of that lovely house and the low hills that cupped it. It was for my daughter, said Beauty's father. All she wanted in the whole world was one white perfect rose. The beast rudely snatched the photograph her father drew from his wallet and inspected it, first brusquely, then with a strange kind of wonder. The camera had captured a certain look she had sometimes of absolute sweetness and absolute gravity, as if her eyes might pierce appearances and see your soul. When he handed the picture back, the beast took good care not to scratch the surface with his claws. Take her, the rose, then, but bring her to dinner, he growled. And what else was there to be done? Although her father had told her of the nature of the one who waited for her, she could not control an instinctual shudder of fear when she saw him. For a lion is a lion, and a man is a man. Yet wild things have a far more rational fear of us than is ours of them. And some kind of sadness in his agate eyes, that looked almost blind, as if sick of sight, moved her heart. He sat impassive as a figurehead at the top of the table. He asked her father to serve them from a buffet and himself ate nothing. How strange he was. She found his bewildering difference from herself almost intolerable. Its presence choked her. There seemed a heavy, soundless pressure upon her in his house, as if it lay under water. And when she saw the great paws lying on the arm of his chair, she thought, they are the death of any tender herbivore. And such a one she felt herself to be. Miss Lamb, spotless, sacrificial. Yet she stayed and smiled because her father wanted her to do so. And when the beast told her how he would aid her father's appeal against the lawyer's judgment, she smiled with both her mouth and her eyes. But when the beast suggested, with a hint of shyness, that she should stay here with him in comfort while her father returned to London to take up the legal cudgels again, she forced a smile. For she knew, with a pang of dread, as soon as he spoke, that it would be so, and her visit to the beast must be, on some magically reciprocal scale, the price of her father's good fortune. Her bedroom contained a marvelous glass bed. She had a bathroom with towels thick as fleece and vials of suave unguents, and a little parlor of her own, the walls of which were covered with an antique paper of birds of paradise and Chinamen. Next morning, her father kissed her and drove away with a renewed hope about him that made her glad. The unaccustomed luxury about her she found poignant, because it gave no pleasure to its possessor, and himself she did not see all day, as if, curious reversal, she frightened him. Loneliness of the beast. All the time she stayed there, she saw no evidence of another human presence, but the trays of food that arrived on a dumb waiter inside a mahogany cupboard in her parlor. Dinner was eggs benedict and grilled veal. She ate it as she browsed in a book, a collection of courtly and elegant French fairy tales about white cats who were transformed princesses and fairies who were birds. She pulled a sprig of muscat grapes from a fat bunch for her dessert, and found herself yawning. She discovered she was bored. At that, the spaniel took hold of her skirt with its velvet mouth and gave it a firm but gentle tug. She allowed the dog to trot before her to the study, and there, to her well-disguised dismay, she found her host seated beside the fire with a tray of coffee at his elbow from which she must pour. The voice that seemed to issue from a cave full of echoes, his dark, soft, rumbling growl. After her day of pastel-colored idleness, how could she converse with the possessor of a voice that seemed to inspire the terror that the chords of great organs bring? Fascinated, almost awed, she watched the firelight play on the gold fringes of his mane. Hesitantly, as if he himself were in awe of a young girl who looked as if she had been carved out of a single pearl, asked after her father's law case, and her dead mother, and how they, who had been so rich, had come to be so poor. He forced himself to master his shyness, which was that of a wild creature, and so she contrived to master her own, to such effect that soon she was chattering away to him as if she had known him all her life. When the little cupid in the gilt clock on the mantelpiece struck its miniature tambourine, she was astonished to discover it did so 12 times. "So late, you will want to sleep," he said. At that, they both fell silent, as if these strange companions were suddenly overcome with embarrassment to find themselves together, alone, in that room, in the depths of the winter's night. As she was about to rise, he flung himself at her feet and buried his head in her lap. She stayed stock still, transfixed. She felt his hot breath on her fingers, the stiff bristles of his muzzle grazing her skin, the rough lapping of his tongue, and then, with a flood of compassion, understood. "All he is doing is kissing my hands." He drew back his head and gazed at her with his green, inscrutable eyes, in which she saw her face repeated twice, as small as if it were in bud. Then, without another word, he sprang from the room, and she saw, with an indescribable shock, he went on all fours. Beauty would pass the day in her suite reading, or perhaps doing a little embroidery, or, well wrapped up, she wandered in the walled garden among the leafless roses with the spaniel at her heels and did a little raking and rearranging. The enchantment of that sad, pretty place enveloped her, and she found that, against all her expectations, she was happy there. She no longer felt the slightest apprehension at her nightly interviews with the beast. She would talk with the lion on the nature of the moon and its borrowed light, about the stars and the substances of which they were made, about the variable transformations of the weather. Yet still his strangeness made her shiver. And when he helplessly fell before her to kiss her hands, as he did every night when they parted, she would retreat nervously into her skin, flinching at his touch. The telephone shrilled. For her, her father. Such news! The beast sunk his great head on his paws. "You will come back to me. It will be lonely here without you." She was moved almost to tears that he should care for her so. It was in her heart to drop a kiss upon his shaggy mane, but though she stretched out her hand towards him, she could not bring herself to touch him of her own free will. He was so different from herself. "But yes," she said, "I will come back. Soon, before the winter is over." Then the taxi came and took her away. You are never at the mercy of the elements in London, where the huddled warmth of humanity melts the snow before it is time to settle, and her father was as good as rich again. A resplendent hotel, the opera, a whole new wardrobe for his darling so she could step out on his arm to parties, to restaurants, and life was as she had never known it. Although the beast was the source of this newfound prosperity, and they talked of him often, now that they were so far away from the timeless spell of his house, it seemed to possess the radiant and finite quality of dream. And the beast himself, so monstrous, so benign, some kind of spirit of good fortune who had smiled on them and let them go. She sent him flowers, white roses in return for the ones he had given her. And when she left the florist, she experienced a sudden sense of perfect freedom, as if she had just escaped from an unknown danger, had been grazed by the possibility of some change, but finally left intact. Yet, with this exhilaration, a desolating emptiness. But her father was waiting for her at the hotel. They had planned a delicious expedition to buy her furs, and she was as eager for the treat as any girl might be. Since the flowers in the shop were the same all the year round, nothing in the window could tell her that winter had almost gone. Returning late from supper after the theater, she took off her earrings in front of the mirror. Beauty. She smiled at herself with satisfaction. She was learning how to be a spoiled child, and that pearly skin of hers was plumping out a little, with high living and compliments. You could not have said that her freshness was fading, but she smiled at herself in mirrors a little too often these days, and the face that smiled back was not quite the one she had seen contained in the beast's agate eyes. Her face was acquiring, instead of beauty, a lacquer of the invincible prettiness that characterizes certain pampered, exquisite, expensive cats. The soft wind of spring breathed in from the nearby park through the open windows. She did not know why it made her want to cry. There was a sudden, urgent, scrabbling sound, as of claws at her door. Her trance before the mirror broke. All at once, she remembered everything perfectly. Spring was here, and she had broken her promise. Now the beast himself had come in pursuit of her. First, she was frightened of his anger. Then, mysteriously joyful, she ran to open the door. But it was his liver and white spotted spaniel who hurled herself into the girl's arms in a flurry of little barks. Yet where was the well-brushed, jeweled dog who had sat beside her embroidery frame in the parlor with birds of paradise nodding on the walls? This one's fringed ears were matted with mud. Her coat was dusty and snarled. She was thin, as a dog that has walked a long way. After that first rapturous greeting, she seized the chiffon hem of Beauty's evening dress, whimpered and tugged, threw back her head, howled, then tugged and whimpered again. There was a slow, late train that would take her to the station where she had left for London 3 months ago. Beauty scribbled a note for her father, threw a coat round her shoulders. Quickly, quickly, urged the spaniel soundlessly. And Beauty knew the beast was dying. In the thick dark before dawn, the station master roused a sleepy driver for her. Fast as you can. It seemed December still possessed his garden. The ground was hard as iron. The skirts of the dark cypress moved on the chill wind with a mournful rustle. And there were no green shoots on the roses, as if this year they would not bloom. And not one light in any of the windows, only in the topmost attic, the faintest smear of radiance on a pane, the thin ghost of a light on the verge of extinction. The door did not open silently as before, but with a doleful groaning of the hinges, and this time onto perfect darkness. Beauty clicked her golden cigarette lighter. The tapers in the chandelier had drowned in their own wax, and the prisms were wreathed with drifting arabesques of cobwebs. Dust everywhere, and it was cold. There was an air of exhaustion, of despair in the house, and, worse, a kind of physical disillusion, as if its glamour had been sustained by a cheap conjuring trick, and now the conjurer, having failed to pull the crowds, had departed to try his luck elsewhere. Beauty found a candle to light her way and followed the faithful spaniel through a house echoing with desertion, up a little back staircase dedicated to mice and spiders, stumbling, ripping the hem of her dress in her haste. An attic with a sloping roof, a nightlight on the mantelpiece, no curtains at the windows, no carpet on the floor, and a narrow iron bedstead on which he lay, sadly diminished, his mane a greyish rat's nest, and his eyes closed. "Oh, beast," said Beauty, "I have come home." His eyelids flickered. How was it she had never noticed before that his agate eyes were equipped with lids, like those of a man? Was it because she had only looked at her own face, reflected there? "I'm dying, Beauty," he said in a cracked whisper of his former power. "Since you left me, I have been sick. I could not go hunting. I found I had not the stomach to kill the gentle beasts. I could not eat. I am sick, and I must die. But I shall die happy, because you have come to say goodbye to me." She flung herself upon him, so that the iron bedstead groaned, and covered his poor paws with her kisses. "Don't die, beast. If you'll have me, I'll never leave you." When her lips touched the meat hook claws, they drew back into their pads, and she saw how he had almost kept his fists clenched, but now, painfully, tentatively, at last began to stretch his fingers. Her tears fell on his face like snow, and, under their soft transformation, the bones showed through the pelt, the flesh through the wide, tawny brow. And then it was no longer a lion in her arms, but a man. A man with an unkempt mane of hair, and, how strange, a broken nose, such as the noses of retired boxers, that gave him a distant, heroic resemblance to the handsomest of all the beasts. "Do you know," said Mr. Lion, "I think I might be able to manage a little breakfast today, Beauty, if you would eat something with me." Mr. and Mrs. Lion walk in the garden. The old spaniel drowses on the grass in a drift of fallen petals.
If you want a lover, I'll do anything you ask me to. And if you want another kind of love, I'll wear a mask for you.
Cupid's a featherweight, flies where he will. Only tricky techniques will keep him still. You've looked for love and found it. That won't do. You need to catch it and retain it too.
If you're concerned to keep us, it's your duty to make us think you're gobsmacked by our beauty. If I'm rocking a Cohen dress, admire the Cohen style. If Tyrian, you love Tyre. Now I'm in mohair.
Mohair, I adore.
Good. Now I'm in a nightie and should be told...
Girl, I'm on fire.
Good, then what?
Aren't you cold? And so to bed. Tell her what's going right. and say whatever turns you on at night.
Only never reveal if you're misled. One false look can dismantle all you've said.
Please don't have hairy legs. I nearly wrote. And please don't let your armpits sprout a goat.
You shouldn't wrench your hair with iron pegs. It's true, some men defoliate their legs.
But some girls have black teeth. It's a disgrace. Surely you don't need telling, wash your face.
You talk to me as if you think I live in Mysia or on some Caucasian cliff. I can use powder when my cheeks are pale. Art supplements the blood if blushes fail.
Yes, but we'd squirm to see you smear your cheek with dregs that stain your bosom as they leak. Your laudanum's from Athens, but breathe deep. It really is the scent of unwashed sheep.
Sure, I use deer marrow. But don't condone its public use. I brush my teeth alone. That's why we say, sorry, I didn't wake up. We need the time to finish off our makeup. Don't peep, whatever joy our makeup brings, the finished face delights, the process mings.
On bad hair days, your bedroom needs a guard. Go brush it in some shrine where men are barred. I was announced too quickly once and found a lady with her wig the wrong way round.
You're funny when you're locked out of a door. At first you're threatening and then you implore.
When we first dated, you let me presume that only I had access to your room. But then you let me think I shared the honour.
Yeah, without that trick, we would have been a goner. The deadest fires will flicker with such stoking. For me, if love's not hurting, it's not working. In matrimony, love will seldom fizz. You want your husband, oh look, there he is. But add a door and some doorman rasp, you can't come in, and love tightens its grasp.
So what? If the straightforward way is halted because the door in front of you is bolted, I slip myself down from an open roof. You'll find the windows too aren't burglar-proof.
Oh, it was for me whom you were in peril.
Oh yes, it's true love, those gestures herald. Kindness is free. Why spend a huge amount of presents when the thoughts can really count? I find that the praise of poems works in your crowd if a seductive man reads them.
Poems win praise for sure, but there's a hitch. I want real gifts. Barbarians charm if rich. Homer could bring all nine muses to Rome, but if that's all you bought, Homer, go home.
How about grapes?
Nah.
Or chestnuts? Amaryllis crave nuts, now doesn't. How changing her will is.
Oh yes, that fruit, sent from your private park. It was something you grabbed at the farmer's market. You promise things, it never harms your health. Your promises hint at some boundless wealth. Once I believed you, hope held for a while.
Hope is a goddess, and she can beguile. If you give women gifts, then off they trot. They gain things from the past while losing squat.
You don't give. You keep being about to give. That's how a barren acre can deceive. We date on Sabbaths when traders are stopping to rest because there's less business.
Less shopping. Sabbaths are good. Your birthday's inauspicious. That's when I end up granting your wishes. You always want a cake when birthday's dawn. And I'm amazed how often you've been born.
Oh, I'm a lucky girl. Let's sit down. He has bounty to unfurl. You're looking so discerning as you buy it.
Oh, you give me kisses. Now I have to buy it. I don't have cash about me.
Oh, that's all right. Make out a check.
Oh, why did I learn to write?
That's Ovid. If a birthday makes him whine, don't get him started on St. Valentine.
Constant sorrow all through his days. I'm him a man of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my life.
talking about salvation. I think there's a great deal of truth in the statement that either you're saved or you ain't. And the best thing to do about it is find out which and stick to it. What counts most is personal satisfaction. At least most people. God knows you'll never get that by straining and struggling for something which you're just not cut out for. Now, I passed through a period in my life in which I struggled. One evening while Gypsy Smith was preaching around this section, I dropped in there and heard this wonderful sermon on spiritual struggle. It started me thinking about the lustful body and how I ought to put up a struggle against it. And the struggle I did for quite a while after that. Chances are it might have still been going on if Lot hadn't brought that woman back with him from Memphis. Showed me just how useless the whole thing was, as far as I personally was concerned, anyhow. Now, Lot came home from Memphis one Saturday morning last summer and brought this woman back with him. I was working out in the south field, spraying the damned army worms, when I seen this Chevy come turning in off the highway onto the drive. I went to the house to meet him. Lot was drunk. "This is my wife," he said. "Her name is Myrtle." I didn't say a word to him. I just stood and looked her over. She had on a two-piece thing, the skirt part white and the top of it blue polka dotted, hung on kind of crooked, showed part of her tits. Biggest I'd ever seen on a young woman's body. Sunburned halfway down to the nipples underneath. Pure white and pearly looking. "Well," she said. "Hello, brother." Made like she would kiss me. But I turned away in disgust because I wanted her to know how I felt about it. It's a real bitch trick marrying a dying man, which she must have known Lot was. Lot was a TB case. And he had it so bad, they had to let the air out of one of his lungs back in Memphis. I guess she must have known what the setup was. The place was Lot's and not mine, even though I did all the work on it. After Dad died and I learned how I'd been fucked, I quit the place and went to Meridian to work in the stave mill there. But I got these pitiful letters from Lot saying, "Would you please come back?" And I did, with the understanding that when Lot died, which is bound to be pretty soon, the place would be mine. Well, I thought to myself after meeting this woman, the sensible thing to do is just lay low, see how things work out. So I went back to the field and continued my spraying. I didn't come in for supper. Went to the Crossroads Inn to drink me some beer. Must have been about 10:30 when I come back to the house. Lamp was on in the kitchen. She was in there heating up something or other on the stove. I didn't light the lid on. I even noticed her presence. I walked right past her and on up to the attic. Pushed my cot in the gable to get the breeze, but there wasn't a breath of it stirring. I thought things over, but I didn't decide nothing yet. Along toward morning, I started to hear some noise. Went downstairs barefoot. Bedroom door was open, and they was in there panting like two hound dogs. Damn. I went outside around the fields till it was sun up, and then I went back to the house. The black girl, Clara, was there to fix breakfast, and after a while, the woman came into the kitchen. She had on a light blue satin kimono, but she didn't bother to fasten around her even. Now, Clara kept looking at me and giggling when she set my plate down. She said, "What are you looking at?" I said, "Nothing much." And she let out a laugh like a horse. I could blame her. Me saying nothing much about them two huge knockers. When breakfast was over, I called Lot out on the porch for a little talk. Now look here, I said. I overheard you last night in the room with that woman. How long you think you'll last in your condition? Inside of a month, that lovely Miss Myrtle will fuck the last breaths from your body and go on back to the Memphis cat house. You must have got her right off fresh as a daisy. Well, that speech of mine made him sore, and he acted like he was going to take a sock at me, but I got mine in first. I knocked him back off the steps. Then she come out, she called me a dirty prick and lots of other nice things like that, and then she started crying. You don't understand, she bawled. I love him and he loves me. I laughed in her face. Last winter, I told her, he took the sheets himself. What do you mean, she asked me. Ask Lot, I told her. Then I walked off and let him chew that over. Ha! I went off laughing. The sun was up good then and hot as blazes. I had my jug of liquor stashed in a clump of snow on the mountain. I went out to it and took a pretty good drink. It made me drunk right off, because I'd drunk a pretty good deal now before. The ground kept tilting up and down like a steamboat. When it was dark, I went up to the house. The lights was turned out, so I turned on a lamp in the kitchen and warmed up supper. There was some coffee left in a pot on the stove. I drunk it black, against my better judgment. Keeps me from sleeping in summer, especially when I'm horny from not getting much, and been 6 weeks since I laid a woman. I thought to myself, I'm 25 and strong. I gotta quit fooling around and get me a girl to go steady with. The air in the kitchen was hot and it seemed to be humming. I guess my blood was kind of overheated. My hand fell down in my lap between my legs. My head was tired, and almost before I known what I was doing, I had it out and started playing with it. Oh, I don't want that. I don't want that, I said. So I got up quick and went around to the big rain barrel out back, and I'd thrown water on my face and over my body. But the water only seemed to make it stiffer. Showed no signs of going back down, either. Two hands barely covered it. So I sat down there beside the rain barrel and jerked my Peter. Moon was out and white as a blonde girl's head. There was no wind. There wasn't a breath of air stirring. I looked upstairs. The lamp was on in their bedroom. I listened a while and I could hear them grunting like a pair of pigs in the sty. Yeah, they was at it again. I thought of her legs, soft as silk without a dark hair on them, and her titties. Biggest I'd ever seen on a young woman's body. And of her belly, round and bulging out. And it sure would be good to press up against it or get her body turned over and up on the knees a little and then climb on and stick it up and under. Good, good, good. It's the best thing in the world, that burning sensation. And then the running over. The sweet relaxing and letting go shot off inside her, leaving you weak and ready for sleep. Yeah, there's nothing like it in all the world. Nothing able to compare with it even. Just that thing and nothing more is perfect. The rest is shit. All of the rest is nothing hardly but shit. But that thing's good. And if you never had Nothing else but that. No money, no property, no success in the world, but still that, why that would still make it worth living for you. Yeah, you could come home to a house with a tin roof on it and blaze in the heat and look for water, not find a drop to drink. And look for food and not find a single crumb in it. But if on the bed you had a naked woman, maybe not even terribly young or good looking, she looked up and said, "I want it, Daddy." Why then, I say you got a square deal out of life, and anybody that don't think so just ain't fucked the right woman. But that sort of thing, it was doing me no good at all. So I went back to the kitchen and filled and lit my pipe. I looked at the sink with the dishes all piled up in it. You know, a lot of improvement this Myrtle had made on the place. But then she wasn't a woman. A woman's a woman, but a cunt is a cunt. And that's what this Myrtle was. She was a cheap piece of tail. You know, I could use on, there wasn't a doubt about that, but if I brought home one to live with, by God, it would have to be one that I was able to feel a little respect for. I went to the screen door to pee. Had to wait several minutes before I could. Long way off, I heard a hound dog baying. Sounded sad. In spite of myself, I went back to my old train of thoughts. It just seemed like my mind was set on the subject. Nothing would stop it. It's like the preacher says, the gates of the soul has got to close on the body. Keep the body out, or the body will break them down and overrun the soul and everything else decent in you. Fact of the matter is, though, I never did seem to have any gates to close. Now, I was made without them. Some people are, I guess. I'd say to myself, this sort of thing is dirty. And I remember what the preacher had said about closing the gates on the soul, and struggling. And I'd reach for the gates to close them and find I hadn't a thing to catch a hold of. I guess my trouble was partly a lack of schooling. Never think of anything much to do but drinking and screwing and doing my damnedest to make something out of the place, but not having much luck at it. I guess if a fellow could pick up a book at night, that ought to make a great deal of difference in him. Oh, I could read. I could make the most out of the words. But dogged if reading would close the gates on the body. Made up stuff is just not satisfying to me. Poker I like to play, but always seem to come out a little at the end of the horn. I like to go into town and look at a movie or a carnival show. But only ever so often. Looking at them screen stars don't close the gates on the body. I don't ever think that it does. There's nothing makes a fellow quite so horny as sitting there in the dark and looking at them beautiful actresses messing around in a little lace steppings or a fancy wrapper. You come back out and there ain't one inch of the soul that ain't overrun by the longings of the body. Well, I was still in the kitchen while the night wore away, but I had a feeling that something was going to happen before the night ended, and I was not mistaken. It must have been about a 12:30 when all of a sudden a big commotion begins. I heard him coughing and then her running and shouting my name in the hall. I just sat tight there, waiting to see what would happen. After a while, she come on down to the kitchen to fill up the water pitcher. "Didn't you hear my calling, you chicken?" she says. I just sat there and looked at her. She filled up the water pitcher and clumped it down on the table. "Lots took sick," she told me. I didn't say nothing. He seems to be awful sick.
I wanted to call a doctor, but he said no, no, no. He'd be all right in the morning.
I didn't say a thing to her.
What's wrong with him?
She asked me after a while. He's got TB, I told her. She put on a shocked expression.
How bad is it?
She asked me. I told her they'd let the air out of one of his lungs at the Memphis hospital because the x-rays had shown it was all eaten up with disease.
Why didn't somebody tell me?
She asked. She sat there and whimpered a little, and I said nothing, but I just kept on looking at her.
I've had a bad time,
she told me.
You don't understand how it is with a woman like me. I used to work in a dry goods store in Biloxi.
What, you planning to give me your life story?
No, 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 she said. I just wanted to tell you something. Then I was thin, and I hadn't dyed my hair, and I looked real pretty. I was 15 then, and I didn't go out with the boys. I was just as nice as any girl you could think of. But you can imagine what happened. The man managed the store, kept walking by me, and every time he did, he would touch my body. First on my arm, and then on my shoulder, and finally on my hips. I told my girlfriend about it. Honey, she said, just take him aside and have a sincere conversation. You tell him you're not used to that sort of treatment. So that's what I done. I went to his office at the back of the store. It was late one Saturday in the middle of summer. I said, Mr. Porter, you seem to be taking advantage of the fact that you're my boss to take some liberties with me, which I don't like because of my decent upbringing. But Charlie just grinned. He walked up to me and he put his hands on my hips. Is this what you mean? He said. And then he kissed me. And then it was all over with me. I tried to walk one way and Charlie pushed me the other. He kicked the office door shut and backed me up against a big roller top desk. And he took me by force right there. He had my cherry right there on that roller top desk. He was a man about 40 with sandy red hair. You know the sort, like a great big bull. And I fell in love with him. I got to admit, he made me so happy that summer, and my memories of it are still the best that I've got. They say you always lose your heart with your cherry. Well, I don't know about that. Some girls don't like it at first, but I got to admit that from the beginning, I loved it.
She wiped her eyes on the edge of the tablecloth. Is that the end of the story?
No, she said. It was only beginning. He got tired of me. Some girls, they'd have made trouble. I could have because I was only 15 at the time, but I had too much pride. So I packed up and moved to Pensacola, then to New Orleans, and finally I come to Memphis. I picked up Lott on the street. He looked like a kid. Sort of thin and pitiful looking. It touched me that he laid on me like a baby. He seemed so lonesome. And it's the truth that I loved him. He slept in my arms just like a baby would, and when he woke up, he said, would I come home with him? And we'd be married. At first I laughed, but then I thought, oh well, as the fellow says, there's a hell of a lot more to it, this business of sex, than a couple of people jumping up and down on each other's eggs. So I said, yeah. And we set out next morning. Now what shall I do? She asked. Do about what? I asked her. You? She said. The minute I laid eyes on you, the first glance I'd look at that big, powerful body, I said to myself, uh-oh, your goose is cooked, honey. So, what shall I do about it? Well, I said, when somebody's goose is cooked, the best way to have it cooked is with plenty of gravy. I picked up the lamp off the table and started up the stairs. She followed on behind me. At the door of Lot's room, she stopped by, and I kept going. I went on up to the attic and dropped my clothes on the floor beside the cot and sat down on it and waited for her to come up, which I known she would do. I don't think I ever in all my life looked forward to anything so much as I did to that woman coming up to bed with me. It went 5 minutes before I heard footsteps on the stairs coming up to the attic, and then I realized I'd been praying. I'd been sitting there praying to God to send that woman up to me. What'd you make of that? What sort of God would pay attention to prayer like that, coming from someone like me who was sold to the devil when thousands of good people's prayers for the sick and the suffering and dying are given no mind, no more than so many crickets buzzing in the summer. But that is beside the point now. Point is, Lot's wife is coming up to bed with me. And when I heard her coming, it stood straight up. You could hang your hat on it. I spread my legs and she come toward me and stopped beside the cot and stroked it and kissed it like it was something holy. She giggled and crooned and carried on like something outlandish. I just lay back and looked at the sky. I enjoyed it. Finally, she wiggled up and got on the cot beside me. I felt of her body, so big and hot like a mountain that had a furnace inside it. I ripped the drawers off her bottom and then I climbed on. She put the head of it in. I gave a push and she yelled out, God Almighty! I drew it back and gave it another shove and she said, Oh, blessed Mary! She said her prayers all of the time I was giving it to her, and when I come, she did it the same time. I swear her yelling nearly took the roof off. Oh, blessed Mary, Mother of God, she shouted. I had to laugh. He must have heard her downstairs, because it was about that time he started bawling out our names. Now, even before I come downstairs in the morning, I known Lot was dead. And sure enough, he was. He'd gotten out of bed and crawled on the floor as far as the door to the bedroom. His body was stretched out halfway over the sill, and the blood, it was now dried in the hot yellow sunlight, had made a stream from the foot of the bed to where his head was resting. I wasn't surprised. Because all that livelong night, we'd heard him bawling out, Myrtle! 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 Later on, I heard him calling my name out. Chicken! Chicken! Chicken!
Once or twice, she said in a half-hearted kind of way, I reckon I better go down and make him hush that godforsaken bawling. But I said, no, bawling's good for his lungs. So we kept right on having our fun up in the attic. Bawling quit by and by, a little while after sunup, and then it was quiet, and I thought to myself, Lot's dead. I called to Myrtle, and she come downstairs too. We stood together in front of the door and looked at him.
Poor little kid,
said Myrtle. She started to cry, but not very much or for long. It's all for the best, I told her. And after a while, she said she guessed it was too. We got hitched up that winter. We have our troubles, but we get on pretty good. As good as most young couples do in the country. We're expecting a baby by the end of the summer. If it's a boy, we aim to call him Lot in memory of my brother. And if it's a girl, I guess we'll call her Lottie. And now it seems like everything in my life is straightened out. I don't ever worry about them spiritual gates the preacher told me to keep shut. Not having no gates can save you a lot of trouble. And after all, what does anyone know about the kingdom of heaven? It's earth I'm after. And now I'm honest about it and don't pretend I'm nothing but what I am. A lustful creature determined on satisfaction. And likely as not to get my full share of it.
This last part's rude. But fortunately, Venus said, we'll decide how rude it is between us. Observe, there's no position that will do. For every woman, find what's right for you. So if you have a pretty face, appear prostrate. Men like your rear will show your rear. Melanion felt Atlantis' thighs around his shoulders. If they're good, that's wise. A small woman should ride. That tour de force Andromache would never ride a horse. A girl whose slinky side would turn her head should flex her neck and kneel upon the bed. If legs are fine and breasts a source of pride, make the man stand. And lie upon your side. Be like a bacchant, liberate your locks, and let them tumble round your throat in flocks. If you've been scarred in childbirth, don't display the marks. Be Parthian, ride the other way. There are 1,000 postures. The least taxing is on your right-hand side.
Semi-relaxing.
Two lovers are in bed. The beds are where? The bedroom doors are shut. Muse, linger where fingers find what to do in secret parts, where Cupid slyly tingles with his darts. So strongest Hector satisfied his wife, war wasn't the sole purpose of his life. Achilles, too, with captive breeches, pressed sheets like this when he left war for peace. Don't hurry, love, I say with confidence. Elicit it, delay it, sense by sense. When you discover spots that give her such delight, then let no shame deter your touch. You'll see her eyes flash with a tremulous gleam, as when the sun flicks waters with its beam. Moans will arise.
Oh!
then a friendly purr.
Meow.
And sweet sighs. Oh. Joking words unique to her.
Schmuck. But don't leave her flaunting your bigger sails. It's not a race where one of you prevails. No, rush together to the line. It's sweet for man and woman both equally beat.
This is the ideal place, at least, when leisure allows, if fear's not rushing a secret pleasure. In which case, ply the oars. You're not secure to wait. Goad bolting horses with a spur.
Take time, and take an older, wiser lover, who takes things that would make a young one suffer. They burn slowly, like hay before it's dried, or timber fresh felled from the mountainside. Young men are quick and fruitful, old ones last. If apples go off quickly, pick them fast.
Don't ask a woman who was head of state when she was born. Let censors keep the date. Especially if her youth has passed, bloom fled, and now she plucks white hairs out of her head. This age or later is what youths should know. The fruit is fieldful, it's a field to sow. Accept the task while strength and years permit before old age. Before old age pads up to finish it, so plough the soil with shares, or seize with oars, or throw your muscle into bloody wars, or give your body to strength, body and care. You need the same tactics and power there.
What's more, they have more prudence in these things. Only they have technique experience brings. They compensate with knowledge of the world, and take some trouble not to seem so old. So you can choose one from a thousand ways to have sex. More than any book displays. Oh, it's me. They do not need provoking to their pleasure. Woman and man feel joy in equal measure.
I love them to express delight and say that I should keep on, that I should delay. I love to see her crazed with conquered eyes or languishing from the contact she denies. These are the benefits nature deprives from most, except the over 35s. Pour me the wine that's been long put away. Those that want to rush, drink Beaujolais. If you prefer rapture that's matured, keep at it, and you will win a fine reward.
Game over. Now it's time the swans depart, whose necks in the oaks drew our poetic cart.
If you liked our tutorial, pass it on.
And just remember,
Ovid was the Don.